Don't you love it? Don't you love basketball? Basketball is the most interesting game. I love the game, and so do you guys.
Welcome to Slapping Glass, where we explore basketball's best ideas, strategies, and coaches from around the world. Today, we're excited to welcome 16-year Utah Jazz assistant under Jerry Sloan during the Stockton-Malone era and current NBA insider on ESPN Radio, Gordy Chiesa. Coach Chiesa is here today to discuss the elements of half-court execution, real-world coaching conversations, and we talk shots that kill your offense, scorers off the bench, and the best Chiesisms during the always fun start, sub, or sit. As we turn to the new year, we're excited to continue growing and building the value of Slapping Glass Plus. Find out more why current members of all levels from over 20 countries are calling SG Plus the best platform to connect, learn, and explore the craft of coaching. Visit slappingglass.com for more information today. We hope to see you there. And now, please enjoy our conversation with Coach Gordy Chiesa. Coach, thank you very much for making the time for us. We're really excited to talk to you.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. Coach, we wanted to start with a conversation you and I had before this podcast about real world coaching conversations and conversations that you have with the staff, with players throughout the season that we all go through as coaches, you know, coming off of a tough loss and guys are disgruntled in the locker room, player misses four shots in a row, all these examples that coaches need to think about and how to handle those things.
Yes, very much. The biggest thing right now is just patience. Understand the dynamics of each player and what the team goals are. So for example, a guy misses four shots in a game. I've always said this to players, is that what you want to do is respect the possession. And I'm not saying don't shoot the ball on the fifth time. I'm saying is that drive the ball into the lane and make a play. It still could be a shot, but more importantly, it tells your floor mates that I'm playing to win. Add to that, any coach that tells a player don't shoot when the player goes to heaven someday on his gravestone will be his date of birth and the day that you told him not to shoot any game. You told him right. Not to shoot any game. So I always say that you miss three or four open shots. All I'm saying is that still be aggressive, but drive the ball into the painted area or a sideline, drive the ball to the basket and make a play.
Coach, love that conversation. I think the shot selection conversation is probably on the minds of many coaches right now. We're mid-season right now, and the roles have kind of been decided on the team for the most part of who's shooting the most shots and from where. But there's always those players that want more and maybe will test you as a coach to take more. And how do you handle those situations and those conversations?
Well, the players that want more shots, I always say, make it happen defensively. So the best way to become a better scorer is to play defense. When you're engaged defensively, the ball always finds you offensively. So the question is, you're in the passing lanes, you dig the ball out in the post, you're a charge taker, loose ball recoveries. And that when you play defense, shots will come to you out of the flow of the offense. Also offensively, besides just spacing out, be a velocity cutter. So much is that when players baseline drive, baseline drift, or baseline drive and you're a big guy, go to the dotted area, into the painted area to be a pass catch option. So the best way to get more shots is movement. That's movement on defense and movement on offense. Instead of feeling sorry for yourself and that when you get the ball, a lot of times the reason why players don't shoot accurately because they predetermine what shot they're going to take. Hey, I haven't touched the ball in the last three or four possessions. When that ball comes to me, I'm going to shoot it. And that's when you get in trouble.
Coach, preaching movement on offense, you know, we've had a lot of conversation with cutting and moving. How do you get guys to move and to cut? I mean, I know it's one thing to say, if you move, you're going to get the shots, but how do you get the buy-in? How do you get them to actually then move and, you know, get them to believe in the movement?
Well, it all starts with the passer. So many times, the reason why the players don't cut as far as movement, they don't trust their floor mate passes, where if I cut, I might not receive the ball. So we do breakdown drills in practice of three on three, four on four. and a 5-on-5 of the setup. So we teach the players how to set up the defensive player, and we teach the passer what to look for. And that most times the reason why players don't cut is because they don't trust the passer, because usually the passer over dribbles. He over dribbles into a pass or his own shot. So we break it down, and then we teach both components, how to cut, when to cut. Just as important is the passer. What do you see on the floor? And that we emphasize it dramatically. Is that so? That's what we call the cut pass scenario.
And with the over dribble, what are kind of the signs that a player is over dribbling? Is it actually a dribble limit, or is it if you've gone too deep? How do you then tell the player, the passer, that, hey, you've over dribbled here?
Most times over dribbling, they dribble the ball laterally. There's too much bouncing sideways versus going forward to make a play, or going forward and make a backtrack dribble to get spacing as far as be able to pass the ball. So we see a player dribbling the ball sideways exclusively. That tells us is that he is over dribbling. For every bounce in a half court situation, you over dribble, it affects the team bounce. And that's the play on words. Over dribbling, bouncing, team bounce, meaning what? They don't believe, quote, in the passer, which then later on, they don't believe in the offensive schemes. And that we're maniacal about not over dribbling. A lot of times on a pick and roll, for example, the players over dribble dramatically to try to set up versus dribbling the ball to get the angle to properly use the screening action, which then forces a space out situation, which now thus you get a good quality shot.
In our conversation before this, you had used a term that I wanted to ask you about, which was invisible earmuffs as a coach. Can you talk a little bit about what that term is and what it means?
Oh, very much. Invisible earmuffs is when your players, especially your scorers, they're yesing you to death by verbal nodding. Yes, yes, I get it. I get it. I get it. However, you as the savvy coach, you know that they have invisible earmuffs, that they're not listening, only temporary hearing. So that now, that's all part of coaching now. You've got to get these guys with invisible earmuffs to be able to play defense some of the time versus none of the time, or pass the ball some of the time versus none of the time. So that we're very conscious of players, even though they're well-intended, they have a situation called invisible earmuffs. And by the way, you're in California. By the way, you're in Germany. It never snows on the court to wear earmuffs.
That's true. So, Coach, my follow-up to that with the invisible earmuffs, does it go both ways? What do coaches need to listen to and not listen to from their players and staffs throughout the season?
Well, so much is the voice tone. It's how you say things to players and how players say things to you. So if you're screaming all the time, it's absolutely, you lose the players as far as their thought process. What I've learned over the years is the messaging of how you say things. Your voice tone is absolutely critical as far as developmental of the player and of your team. Likewise, if the coaches on your staff, if they're maniacal how they talk to the head coach about some sort of urgency, often the coaches will turn themselves off to that suggestion. So when I worked for the late, great Jerry Sloan for 16 years, from 1989 to 2005, I figured out during the course of a game that I had 5 to 7 times to say something to Jerry that hopefully was thoughtful, and that it was my voice tone of how you say things. Even though the game is intense, the practice are intense, the meeting with the player is intense, you have to be composure of how you say things. And I always say that when it's going to be a negative conversation, use less adjectives. If it's going to be a positive conversation, use more upbeat adjectives. And what that does, it opens up the player's mind or the listener of what you're saying has tremendous value. Please listen.
Coach, that was a great point. I'm sorry, could you go a little deeper on that about conversations, about negative conversations and positive conversations and the adjectives that you do or should not use?
Oh, very much. So here's reality for a coach. You're in a 4-game losing streak and your best player is shooting way too quick and is not playing defense. And everybody knows on the team that that's a huge component of why we're not successful. And the guys that are hustle players / role players, they're playing their role and they're excelling in it. But it's the main guys that have the most talent. That's your best coaching, when you've got to get the main guys that are difference makers to understand what it takes to win. So we're in the office. We're one-on-one, mano a mano. And you are talking to that player that you genuinely like, but you've got to get he or she to play better. So it's the words you use. So, for example, I would say a conversation like this. Hey, I know you want to win. However, what we see right now is that you're taking too many, and then be specific of what that player is not doing correctly. But it's how you say to them. It's how you pause for effect. And by the way, don't overtalk, because the players can't process it. The people in the room, we're the adults. The players are young adults, and that we're trying to get them to understand of what it takes to win. And then have a natural pause and let the player respond. And don't be defensive when the player is saying things that you dramatically disagree with. Mm-hmm. So there's always a commonality that you've got to respect the player, what he's saying. And usually most players, after they leave the one-on-one conversation, they always feel better.
Sure.
They might not agree with the head coach or the coaching staff, but they always feel better. At least my words are being heard versus being squashed.
Coach, within that conversation, when the player does respond or does give his opinion, how, as a coach, do you filter that information? You know, maybe moving forward, if he is maybe making some good points, or maybe he's making points out of kind of his ego or being selfish and not blowing him off, but, you know, obviously then getting him on track and falling in line and not having him feel, hey, I told coach about this and there's been no change, or he hasn't done anything.
Well, the way to do that is that know his personality and really understand of what his goals are, both individually and team-wise, and then try to work together. And what you want to do is that you don't want to embarrass the player in the one-on-one meeting, and more importantly, in front of his peers, meaning what? His teammates. Mm-hmm. And actually during the game, remember, often there's teammates and then there's floor mates. A teammate is somebody that you see all the time off the court and he's your friend. But a floor mate is somebody that you play the game with for 31 minutes a game, or more than that, as far as executing with. And so that we always talk about is that your floor mates want you to do well. And don't you want your floor mates to play better? And that's what we talk about. We try to get both the players on the court with that player that's going to be a problem. We try to solve the problem together as a unit. But again, we don't embarrass the player because he's going to rebel against you.
Coach, thinking on this example, I'm glad you brought it up, because me and Dan were actually talking about it before. But if we take this example out of instead of a four-game losing streak, maybe it's in the game and your best player, like you said, he's not a defender and he's not playing well. As a coach, what are the decisions you have to make between, do we just try to feed him? Do we try to get him going on offense versus maybe it's not his night, we got to pull him out and put someone else in, but risk losing him further down the line or having him be upset for the next games?
Yes, well, we do that. So there's a concern that the scorer is not defending. We would make it a value judgment, either switch his defense, switch matchups, or after thoroughly trying to get him engaged defensively, we would temporarily sub him out just for a possession or two to talk to him, call him in the sideline, and say to him, you're going back in on the next dead ball.
Okay. Yeah.
Because we need him to score the ball. See, a lot of times you could be the heavy. By the way, your job is to win. So it's that unbelievable fine line. See, usually the best scorers put stress on the coach mentally because they're not totally engaged defensively. The lesser scorers usually are engaged defensively, but they can't make fourth quarter buckets the last 3 minutes of a game for the knockout punch. You need both to win.
Hey, coaches, we'd like to take a quick break to tell you about today's sponsor, Instat. They have been hands down the biggest resource we've used in generating our content. Their expansive database of over 30,000 players and 7,000 teams gives us the access we need to scout, notice trends, and learn from some of the best coaches in the game today. So join coaches of all levels who are using Instat to better prepare for their opponents, self-scout, and develop their players. By going to instatsport.com/form and entering the promo code SGPOD, coaches can receive 1 free month of Instat Scout and 10% off their subscription. That's sgpod@instatsport.com/form. Thanks again to Instat for their support. And now back to our conversation.
Coach, maybe a good way to transition into the second part that we'd love to talk to you about, which is all the ins and outs of offensive execution, specifically in the half court. And so what are some of the key elements that you've seen over the course of your career of teams that really execute well in the half court?
Timing. The first thing is absolutely timing. Usually speaking, that unfortunately, either the point guard or the players on perimeter enter the ball, they start the offensive set where the rest of the floor mates are not in position. So they enter the ball to the wing, and the opposite side of the floor is still getting to a certain position to be part of the formation. So we are maniacal about not starting a certain formation. We do drills about that. We call this 5-on-0 perfect execution, where the head coach is the sole judge of the execution, and the assistant coaches yell to the team what they want to run. So, for example, just say we're going to run flex offense for the narrative. The team flows at half court into transition offensively, and if the player enters the ball when everybody's not up in a formation, the head coach yells, no point, and the next group goes down the floor to the next set play. So that so much is the timing to start the play. Next part of it is the screening action. That's what we call the partnership of screening, is that you don't accept a screen if you are a cutter or a dribbler until you hear the screener or screeners pop their feet, meaning 1-2 pop on the floor. That tells you that we are now going to accept the screen. If there's no pop of the screening action, we don't use the screen. So what that does, that eliminates or limits dramatically illegal screens. It's an awful feeling when the referee calls an illegal screen on your big guy that you need to rebound later on in the game, so that we don't let that happen. We do everything possible. And the next part of it is that, what are we trying to get in the offensive set? Is it a layup? Is it a jump shot? Or we don't know. So the first thing we always talk about, we want to get as many layups as we can. We want to get as many uncontested shots that we can. And the last thing is that we want to get as many as we can organize a solo plays. Usually our set offense is that we run it for the first two options. After two options, now we're in a creative game. So we try to get a layup, a jump shot. Now we're going to create off the dribble, organize, not create off the dribble because you feel like it.
Coach, quickly going back to, I really liked what you said, making the pop sound for the screening. So when there is no pop, so obviously the screen isn't set, what is then the guy who's supposed to receive the screen doing?
All right, he's going to go now organize solo one-on-one.
Okay.
So that if there was no pop right now, he's now going into a baseline drive, baseline drift. He's going to try to snake dribble into penetration. And now we're into the concept game, all because his floor mate didn't pop on his screen. But again, we do so many drills. So the question is always is, what fundamental for a player that it becomes a habit? For some guys, it's the first time you teach it, it's a habit. For players, it might take a month. Some players, it might take 2 years. Some players, it might be never. So that we're maniacal, again, about getting players to do certain attention to detail that we teach in practice.
Yeah.
It's so important, is that the teaching drills that you do, where the player, it becomes a formed game habit.
Coach, if we can maybe drill down on one specific screen action for a second and the teaching points on that screen. You talk about popping your feet to set a screen and then to use a screen. When teaching a guy to set, let's say, like a pin down screen, when does he pop his feet to set the screen? You know, so he's sprinting down to try to find the defender. And how much does he move or not move before that screen is set, so that they can really get a good screen on the guy and the guy doesn't just slip underneath or slip over the top because they're set too early and they're stationary?
Sure. That's the pre-screen value. So that we teach the screener, he's going to screen an area and it's up to the cutter to take his defender into the screen. So the teaching point is that the cutter brings the defensive player into the screen versus the screener brings the picking action into the cutter. It's a big difference. And so the setup is that, again, we teach all the time for the cutter of the screening action to walk away from the screen first. Walk away to set up the screening action of golden going shoulder to shoulder. If you see the defensive player guarding you topside to the screen, don't accept the screen. Automatic what? Back cut.
Yeah.
So that if he's underneath you on your body, walk him away. So it's the screening action starts. In other words, they form the screen, and then there's the walk away from the screen. Now becomes now the action now is activated. So the cutter activates the screen, not the screen activates the cutter.
Sure.
Big difference. Again, the timing of it.
Coach, with that walk away, if we're looking at the pin down, is the walk away mean like if he's on the 45 to literally walk towards like the corner, or is he walking in towards the basket before he uses the screen?
Yeah, he's walking to the baseline. Yeah.
Okay.
He's walking to the screening action. That's the setup. And again, is that it's usually what you do, you want to start slow to cut fast versus a fast cut, and then the defense can time you. So what you want to do is change tempo of the cut. Because you remember, you're not sure how the player is playing you.
Yeah.
So we always say, is the player on your body, off your body? That's the first premise we talk about as far as the cutter. On or off? If he's on your body, it's a perfect time now to set him up. If he's off your body right now, a lot of times you're going to take the cutter to the screen and then make a fade cut to the corner or to the wing area, because now he's going over the top of the screen and you don't accept the screen then. Remember, so a lot of times the screening action is that if I'm the screener and they don't accept my screen because they back cut or fade, me as the screener, as we call peek, we form a screen and then we peek over our shoulder to see my floor mate, how he uses it. If he runs a back cut or a fade, I'm going to either step back or slip cut into the lane based on what my floor mate did on the screening action. So that's what we call the partnership of screening. We don't know who's getting the shot. All we know is that we're going to get a fluid shot based on fundamentals.
Coach, I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't at least ask you a little bit about the Stockton Malone pick and roll, specifically why that was so successful when it comes to the partnership of screening, accepting it, reading it, and all the things that they did that made it so successful.
Well, again, the timing of it. So it's the exact same principles that we taught John and Carl as far as the partnership of screening, the exact same thing. You're the dribbler on a pick and roll. Your job is to get the defensive player below the screening action. Remember, as the dribbler, it's your job to bring the ball into the screening action, not the screener into the ball. See the difference?
Yeah.
So that there's more space involved. And that also is that what made John and Carl so great at it, which John would have, we call it a cadence dribble, where he'd set up his defensive player by going below the screening action, and that at the point of attack, he would read the defensive player both either on his body, off his body, but also he'd read the coverage of the big guy. Did the big guy above the screen, did he arm show as far as have a show? Was he playing center field? Meaning he's off the screen, allowing his teammate to go over or under. And that's what John would take, John slash this generation, Chris Paul, they would take that 16-foot pop shot over the top of the defense because he got screened. If they switched on it, it was an automatic rescreen action. So anytime the defense switched on it, it's an automatic rescreen action into now the screener would flip the screen. And he'd what now? Velocity roll to the basket. On a rescreen action, you wouldn't pop. You'd always roll to the basket and to tag the roller on his inside shoulder. Most times the defensive player is late getting there. They tag outside shoulder. That gives a great pass to the dots for a layup. These are all, again, it's all based on timing and read. Successful pick and roll is reading the defense, not predetermining what shot I'm going to take.
Coach, I know you went through it, but why would you guys rescreen the switch rather than they switched and then let's go to Carl Malone in the post right away?
Because we know that on the second time in the switch, it'll be a loose switch and that we still have so many more options on it. So most times when they switch it, it's a loose switch and they're still confused.
Okay.
Coach, with the game now, there's so much slipping ghost screen action out of the pick and roll where guys aren't popping their feet and setting. They're just running through or they're just slipping early. What are your thoughts on that being a new element of the pick and roll, and I guess how you would then have the guards read and navigate a quick slip rather than the actual screen?
Well, again, so we're saying philosophically that a ghost screen is when the defensive player is clearly above the screen, is top shoulder, above it. And that's an automatic slip, so that if the dribbler sees in the coverage now, the defender on the screener is clearly above my floor mates forming the screen, that's an automatic slip to the basket. And that, usually speaking, the passer will pass the ball off the dribble, where he's dribbling for the setup, and he's going to fire that ball organized to the screener that slipped on it. Mm-hmm. So we put so much stress on the defensive player to try to recover. So we teach it all the time also. It happens very much where in coverage, they are above the screen. It's an automatic slip.
I'd like to throw another scenario at you, another screening action, mainly the screen, the screener, or the T game. And kind of going back on the timing of that screen and when the guy who set the initial cross screen should accept the down screen, how long should he stay in the screen? What timing makes it more successful in your opinion?
Well, the timing of it is that the first part of it is that on that screen to screener action is that you're trying to get a layup on it. So again, I formed the screen, I pop my feet. The player's accepting the screen, he's going to walk away most times to the baseline, and then he's going to come off shoulder to shoulder. And then when the down screen happens is that the passer is so much as the passing angle, so that that passer initially is angling, dribbling to try to throw a layup pass. And if that's taken away, he's going to redirect his dribble and then try to go more towards middle to throw what? An elbow pass opposite for a jump shot. So that it all starts with the passer, how he readjusts his angle to make two sorts of passes, layup or jump shot. If you're the original screener, your job is to set the proper screen to get a layup, and then you become now a jump shooter. So don't think about taking a jump shot first. First, try to form the screen to get a layup for your floor mate, and then the second screener is coming down to get a screening action for you. So much is what the timing of it and the patience of it. Most times, just generally speaking, most cutters, they cut too quickly versus showing patience. And usually when you set a patient screen, you become a much more valuable cutter within the next 2 or 3 seconds.
With that cross screen, and you mentioned most of the times you want the big going over, is there a certain angle then that you want the cross screen being set at? Or is it basically, you know, back to the sideline? Or is it being on the high side or the low side of the screen, the angle-wise?
Well, most time angle-wise would be, usually speaking, remember, the defense is not cooperating. They're putting a body on you. Yeah. So they're trying to, quote, without holding you, they're trying to stand you up as far as setting a screen. There's an element of physicality. So if the world is almost perfect as far as screening action, we'd like to start to form the screen at the basket line. In other words, right at the basket line to form the screen. Mm-hmm. That's why it's so important. The recipient cutter, he walks away first to let the physicality come into play. And now his teammate, meaning a screener, is going to eventually work his way into the screen, which would be set most times at the basket line, the imaginary line of the basket in the lane, most times, which now it gives you, hopefully, if the defense gets confused of screening, a lot of times, remember, the defense runs right into the screen. That's what we call dish rag defense, where the defensive player runs into the screen, and that gives you what? You start to cut high, and now you finish low cut for a layup.
With the timing of the down screen, and you said the top guy's going to go shoulder to shoulder. So after he clears your shoulder, is that when that pin down should be coming and the guy should be taken off? Or should he be staying there and trying to bury the guy for a little bit longer?
He's going to try to bury the guy a split second longer. And then the screener is going to try to screen middle. In other words, again, that the second screen should be more at the middle of the basket line also. Mm-hmm. And what that does is that if we set two proper screens, is that that will allow us to, for the original screener, now to be at the basket line already. And now he is going to cut away from the screen and get more of a jump shot by the elbow slash towards middle, which means now the passer is going to make a slight angle bounce or two to throw a pass to the players, to the original screener's inside shoulder for a catch and fire jump shot. So again, it's all interwoven. We like setting screens at the basket line. not at the elbow. Because the elbow, then it's poor spacing. Because remember, usually speaking, there might be a player on the same side corner, and that defensive player now is going to give help as far as on the screening action. So we like to move the player from the wing to the corner to get that player out of there.
Coach, my last question, maybe a broader discussion moving out of this, and obviously with that cross screen, is how guards can be good screeners. And I know I've always heard, you know, or that John Stockton was always one of the toughest guys to get screened by. So what goes into being a good guard screener?
One is courage. Two is getting the proper angle. Usually speaking, a guard is smaller. A guard's going to set a screen on a bigger defensive player. So what you want to do is that you want to jump stop on the screen and pop your feet fundamentals, in that when the defensive player who's now guarding the cutter, when he comes towards you, you want to set your hands and try to get underneath the defensive player who's trying to ward off the contact as the cutter. So set the screen and get your arms up under to almost like uplift the defensive player off the ground. So again, the big guy, the cutter, has to also walk away. It's the same fundamentals, but you're trying to set a screen and get up under the big guy to try to stand him up as far as guarding your floor mate, meaning the cutter.
Coach, can you just clarify what you mean by get under? How is he getting under the big guy to stand him up?
He's putting both his arms close to him, in that he is, as a defensive player, has his arm out extended. One arm, you're trying to get both your arms under him, almost like interlocking his arm to stand him up.
Okay.
Not extending your arms, you're trying to get up under him. Mm-hmm. So that one of his arms now is not being occupied by your two close arms elbows. Occupy one of his hands to get him upright out of position.
I want to transition now into a segment that we call start, sub, or sit. And we will give you three different basketball topics, ask you to start one, sub one, and sit one. And then we'll have a discussion from there. So coach, we'll dive right in on this. So the first one is themed offensive killers. And we got to give you a little credit for this because you had a tweet somewhat similar to this question for you. But these are offensive shots or shot selections that can really kill your offense or make it hard to score. So start, sub, or sit. Start being the one that's the worst, that'll hurt your offense the most. Pull up threes, especially in transition, wild drives to the rim, or first side shots, threes with no passes swung to that second side. So start, sub, or sit, the worst of those three actions.
Dribble drives to the basket out of control.
Okay.
Start, because that's when usually it's a wild shot. It could be a turnover. You have no chance of defending the basket in transition. So that'd be the worst scenario. The quick shot in transition would be the start, and then the sub would be the last one as far as the ball on the same side, not swinging it.
Got it.
Again, they're all bad. The answer is, unfortunately, they're all bad. And what happens is that, so here's a question for the viewers right now, is that how many drills do we all do as coaches as far as full court shooting drills offensively? So for example, when's the last time you drilled every day in practice or three times a week in practice of early offense taking a pull-up three-point shot? When's the last time?
Yeah.
Hardly ever. Yet players do it all the time. Why? They're playing under adrenaline. And so that shot, even though it's a momentum shot that goes in probably, just guesstimating, once every four times. You have to practice that shot. We like to think that is that the only time you would do that in a game would be if it's a, especially in the NBA, it'd be 2-for-1, the last 35 seconds of each quarter where you're coming down, you're trying to get the last shot of the quarter. So you might take a pull-up three in transition. Unless you're Stephen Curry, you're the world's greatest shooter.
Right.
I had the privilege to coach Ray Allen, the second greatest shooter of all time. And we should allow Ray to do that. When I coached Jeff Hornacek with the Jazz, also another great shooter, is that we'd allow him to do that also. But it's got to be a selective person to be able to make that shot.
Coach, all three of these obviously can be killers offensively. With the wild drives one, what's the teaching point on a player that is aggressive and you want them to get in there, and just getting better at decision-making, attacking versus, you know, not just throwing something up there that then puts you in transition, like you mentioned?
Well, the thing is that you want to be under control both with the dribble and with your mind and with your body. So there's three parts of it. So that when you aggressively drive past the initial defensive player, and now when you get into the lane area, you've got to get your mind under control, your body under control, and your ball under control so that you've got to slow down with the dribble, even though you're aggressive coming there. And it's possible that the help defense makes you take a second dribble, meaning we'll say a crossover dribble or a pullback dribble to get space and separation. But you've got to be able to slow down so that most people get in trouble where they drive to the basket aggressively, but they don't put their mind under control. So generally speaking, when you do penetrate, as I always say, is that do you see the help defensive players' jerseys clearly? If you see the help defensive jerseys numbers clearly, that tells you either to take a lane floater or switch hand dribble into the lane. If you see the players' jerseys only half numbers, that tells you, but still penetrate and go body to body and try to force a N1 play. So the question is the defensive players' numbers, are they open or are they closed?
Okay, Coach, our second one, this has to deal with fighting over the screen. So getting your guard to get over the screen. So start, sub, sit, in terms of a teaching point that to help them get over the screen, start, sub, sit, get their hand over the screen, get their shoulder over the screen, or get their leg, their top leg or inside leg over the screen.
Okay, the worst scenario would be only their hand over the screen. That's the worst scenario. The best way to do that would be get your shoulder there first. So the best way is your shoulder, get your shoulder through the screen, and then your legs will follow, and then your hands will follow that. Mm-hmm. So much is that, just from a teaching point, is that what you want to do is you want to drop your lead shoulder below the screen is hips, below his hips. So once I get my shoulder below the hips, then my footwork's going to follow, and so will my hand. So many times the defensive player runs into the screen head on, and that's what we call dish rag defense. They're like a dish rag. They run into the screen and they fall down like a dish rag at the point of the screen. So shoulder one, legs two, and then hand three.
And when fighting over the screen, you said, so you'll have them get low, and of course, you're going to have them get physical. Will the defender still say perpendicular to the screen, or will you try to get on his hip? What is kind of the pre-movement before you start to get work on getting your shoulder over?
Okay, you always take the cut up into the screen as the defensive player into the screening action. Then you, this we call ride and decide. Ride and decide is when you decide to either stay on his body and fight through the screen below the shoulder, so the screen is hips, or you take the cutter to the screen and you decide based on how accurate the cutter is slash shooter, where the location of the screening action and also the time and score of a game. And as I decide to go either single space through and then meet the cutter later on in the screening action, ride and decide.
And will that still apply for on-ball screens for pick and rolls?
Very much. So pick and roll is that I take the dribbler to the screening action. I'm on his body. Then I decide the coverage of what I'm going to do. Again, based on who the dribbler is, based on his shooting ability, and based on what coverage you're in. Yeah. Again, so many times switch defense, you're asking a big guy to switch onto an elite dribbler. He or she can't do that. So much is that you decide if you're the big in the coverage, meaning the player that's guarding the screener, can he really truly play cushion defense and against a superior offensive player? Most times they can't. It's not their fault, the big in the coverage.
Coach, our next start, sub, or sit, this one has to do with role players off the bench and the type of player that you prefer to bring off the bench to kind of help your team in certain spots. So start, sub, or sit, the score, the microwave guy that you can put in and will get you points right away. The specialist, so maybe that's someone that's defender, rebounder, or maybe just like a spot up shooter type, or the glue guy. So someone that comes in and isn't really going to do much maybe offensively, but just defends and moves the ball and does what you need to do.
I would lean to one. The most important one is the scorer. Usually speaking, the scorers come into the game. That's their job, to be able to score the ball. So number one would be the scorer. And then we embrace that player. And that usually speaking, you don't start your five best players. You start your five players that play as a cohesive unit so that your sixth man should be a wild card type player, usually scoring the ball, and you embrace it. And then when you sub in the game, his floor mates that try to execute, they really want him to shoot the ball. The next scenario would be a defensive specialist that he comes in the game and that he would try to slow down the rival's top score that's given you so many headaches during the game. And a lessonary would be the person that's a glue a guy that ball moves. But usually speaking, I would lean towards the glue guy to be a starter, unless he's so deficient offensively where you have to hide him offensively. So if you, a glue guy is a hard time scoring, he becomes an automatic cutter on ball side. If a player can't score the ball, but is a glue guy slash defensive minded, he becomes an automatic cutter all the time or ball mover, because you don't want him to be on the same side of the floor with the ball, because now the defense now is going to double team all the time the ball handler or the scorer who has the ball.
Obviously, all three of these are on, you've coached and are on teams all across the world right now. My question is on just the depth of a bench. And in your career, when you have a tight unit or a tight rotation, 7, 8, 9, you know, everybody says we have a lot of depth and we like to play a lot of guys, but really when it gets down to it, how many guys do you feel is the most effective in a tight rotation?
9 at every level. Because remember, during the course of the season, players are going to get injured, and players are going to have illness as far as, you know, flu, et cetera. And so your job as a coach is to develop the bench. And that, again, let's say, for example, your young sophomore, age 15, big guy that's got, quote, potential, you've got to play him on the court with other more experienced players so that some of his glaring non-strengths do not come to be exposed. If you play him as an off-the-bench guy with the other reserves, he'll be more exposed. So I always say that your eighth or ninth man, generally speaking, should play X amount of minutes with the starters. And usually that starter should be the glue, hopefully, point guard, so that those players' non-strengths, they're not exposed. I would lean towards 9, and that's the job of a coach. Our eighth or ninth person on our team, they're dramatically lesser. But your job is to get them some playing time that they're ready to play slightly better with the starters because they feel more comfortable and their roles are going to be what? Either screening action, a defensive player, a layup shooter, run the floor in transition versus exposing them of what they can't do well. So, example, if a big guy is a non-perimeter shooter, don't give him the ball on a pick-and-pop situation. Insist on him rolling to the basket. So bench development is critical for a team, both short-term and long-term.
Coach, I have a follow-up about the microwave score, and maybe also kind of brings it back to our original conversation about coaching kind of real-world philosophy, where you mentioned you don't always want to start your best players. And so maybe you want to bring a guy off the bench who can score and have more of a five-man cohesive lineup to start. When your microwave player, your scorer, he has it going and you're going to finish the game with him and maybe pull out one of the glue guys. I mean, obviously this is a good problem to have, but what are the thoughts maybe as you go through the preseason, as you get your rotation, as far as like, how are we going to incorporate that six man into a finishing lineup? And how are we going to play when maybe he's used to coming in and going against the second string and basically all the offense is running through him?
Well, during team practice, we have the exact same scenario. We teach time and score during games. And that, so we would have him in that playing scenario with the starters practice. So we would actually do games where time and score, where he's in the game at a certain time, and these are the plays we're going to run for him or the actions we're going to run for him to get him going. And the team would recognize his strengths, and that we'd only take him out of the game is when he's in foul trouble or that he becomes a defensive liability on certain plays. Mm-hmm. So we'd practice how we're going to play the end of a game. So much is embracing what a player does versus, again, and I'll add to that, your job as a coach is to hide each player's non-strength. You might not tell the player what his non-strengths are because it have hurt feelings, but your job is to hide his non-strengths in the game. So again, if a player is only an average ball handler against full court pressure, don't have him handle the ball. Get him out of there and invert your offense and have some of your bigger guys that are maybe better ball handlers versus the other team's big guys that can't guard in transition as far as up the floor. So we'd practice that all the time.
Yeah.
I like scoring. End of a game, you've got every coach in the history of mankind, including you guys, you think in the fourth quarter, we're not going to score a bucket. Every coach has that fear about not scoring a bucket. So if that's our fear, whether it's good, bad, or ugly, We're going to practice it. All we ask of the players that are microwave scorers, will you please understand time and score yourself? Don't be so reckless where it's only about you. Take aggressive shots out of the team offense. Again, we teach it. Getting back, you mentioned earlier about if a player misses two or three, four shots in a game, we want it to be aggressive, but drive the ball to the basket and make a play. What's the play? I don't know. It could be your shot, but more importantly, you're saying to your floor mates that the most important thing right now is getting a team basket, not my basket.
For sure. Coach, this is kind of off the cuff here. Start, sub, or sit, these three different Che-isms.
I love it. This sounds dangerous.
Yeah, so, start, sub, sit, these three different quotes that I know that you've used quite a bit. One is the horses trot, players run, right? That was the quote we talked about before. The second one is the coaching world is two blocks long. And the third one is never drive baseline on a guy wearing black socks.
All right. The worst one is the never drive baseline on someone wearing black socks. You know why, Dan? You know why, Pat? Because you're playing at lunchtime with guys you don't know or with women you don't know. And that you drive baseline and you're a competent player and you're good. But the guy guarding you is wearing black socks, usually with a headband that says something about California on it. All right? All right? And he's probably wearing frayed cut-off jeans. Yeah. And you might play against the world's greatest players and never get hurt. But in this scenario, you drive baseline and the guy falls on you. You get a sprained ankle. You get a hip pointer because he's out of control. Thus, I coined the phrase, never drive baseline if someone wears black socks, usually at lunchtime at okay. a pickup game. And Dan, you don't want to go back to your boss with a sprained ankle. Now affects your practice that day.
You're right.
At the next scenario, when horses trot and players run, we've all coached players that in defensive recovery, they buddy run with the rival opposing player. So the guy you're guarding isn't running back. So then you decide not to run back in recovery. So horses trot, players run back. The best scenario would be you run back and get a back tip. So my question for all the coaches out there, how many of your players get a back tip in transition? How many players? Imagine if each player that's a starter in the front court can get one back tip in transition. You get, I call those U-turn baskets. I get a back tip and suddenly I turn around and get a basket the other way. And the last one is that, oh, by the way, the whole coaching world is two blocks long, that we know someone that knows someone else that knows someone else. That's why it's so important, relationships. So Patrick, you and I have not met. You're in Germany right now. I'm in Salt Lake City. But by the way, I'm a native New Yorker, New Jersey. And Dan right there is from California. So here we are, all three of us are total strangers, but you know something? The whole world is two blocks long in coaching. Isn't that special?
Absolutely.
Very true.
Very true.
Keeps our podcast going.
Yes, absolutely.
One actually follow-up, Coach, is on that back tip. Are you just saying be active with your hands or see the ball? I mean, of course, sprint back being the first one.
Yeah, what you want to do in transition is that you want to chase the dribbler from behind up until the top of the circle, then you release and go into coverage. But up to that point, to say the dribbler is coming down to half court and you're trailing, you want to run your body through the ball, not your body through the dribbler, which then would create a foul. So my whole thing is that I didn't get the offensive rebound. I'm guarding this guy on the opposing team that's unmotivated to try to get a layup. I'm going to try to get a back tip steal so I can get a U-turn basket and dunk in the guy's noggin who didn't run back initially.
And Coach, on that back tip, you're teaching the tip to not to swipe down on the ball, but to tip it up.
Right, to tip it up. Yeah. Absolutely, tip it up. Flick, as you call a back tip, flick.
Yes.
Flick up at the ball. And that it's really powerful. In Utah Jazz basketball in yesteryear, when Karl Malone, when we challenged him, he was absolutely spectacular getting back tips in transition. And it ignited our two-way offense. Usually speaking, when your big gets a back tip in transition and he scores eventually that basket on U-turn basket, everyone's playing. Suddenly we're pressing out of intensity. Yeah. So suddenly everyone's pressing without even calling it. And now we're trying to get a flurry of steals all because one of our bigs decided to be highly motivated and get it back to him. Don't you love it?
Yeah.
Don't you love basketball? Basketball is the most interesting game. I love the game, and so do you guys.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. And coach, you just bring up another good point, and you mentioned about, you know, the U-turn baskets or these baskets that you can get that are outside of your offense or just kind of in these like middle areas. But another one I know you and I talked about was anytime a team makes a three-point shot, to outlet it quickly and get the ball up the floor and try to maybe score after a three, because the other team is usually, you know, celebrating or whatnot, right?
Celebrating. Correct. Very much. So they make a three against you, whether it was good defense, whether it was poor schematically, is that we inbound the ball quickly and try to get it. We call it a strike basket. And that could be a running layup. That could be a dribble penetration for a kickout three. And that we try to quickly take a shot versus a scramble defense that has an element of celebration because they made a three. I call that power to the people baskets, where they start pounding their chest and their power to the people. And we're going to make them not pound their chest because we're going to score within hopefully 4 to 6 seconds to counterpunch that made three against our defense.
Well, coach, you're off the start, sub, or sit hot seat. Thank you for playing that game with us. That was a lot of fun going through all those scenarios. So we've got one question for you to close. But before we do, this has been really fun. So thank you very much for your time and all your thoughts this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
A question that we ask almost all the guests in closing here is, what's one of the best investments that you've made in your career as a coach?
Besides being married to my wife for 41 years?
Sure.
That's very much it. But also add to that is that relationships with other coaches. That you'd be amazed with coaches that you interact with them is that we all have the exact same problems. As far as that, we're trying to balance between professional life with family life and personal life. And so it's that unbelievable, invisible balance that you have to be very conscious of. Most coaches have a hard time balancing it, but the people that last for a lifetime is that they're able to navigate with their loved ones about what it takes to be successful, both as far as personal, marriage, professionally, and also of being a friend to all. That's what we all try to strive for. And that's one of my advice to people is to be very conscious of it. No one's perfect, but you're always trying to be the best you can be in all sorts of forms.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Please make sure to visit slappingglass.com for more information on the free newsletter, Slapping Glass Plus, and much more. Have a great week coaching, and we'll see you next time on Slapping Glass.
Do we have a name yet for this thing? I have like Slapping Backboard.
Slapping Glass.
Slapping Glass. That's kind of funny.
I like that. That's good. Those are all Slapping Glass.